Good evening. This is Life Rattle, your story show, and I'm your host, Virginia Ashbery. Tonight, Life Rattle number 1358 features six classic stories from Life Rattle writer Ingrid Sevels. Ingrid Sevels was born the middle of three children in Sweden, just after her parents escaped from their native Latvia, then under Soviet occupation, in an 18-foot fishing boat. Her parents came to Canada in 1950 and worked on a farm outside Kingston, Ontario for 2 years before moving to Toronto. Sevels grew up in the Riverdale neighborhood and then attended the University of Toronto in dentistry. She graduated and married in 1971. The couple had their first child in 1973, then moved west to Oakville. Her third child was born in 1977. Ingrid Sevels lives and works in Oakville, Ontario. We're going to hear all six stories by Ingrid Sevels about a trip she made to Latvia in 2001. Sevels' direct prose, her wry observations, and her sharp eye and ear for detail remove any traces of false sentiment in this trip back to the motherland. These stories together form a larger narrative, so I'm going to let them play through without interruption, just a little theme music between each. So let's listen now as Ingrid Sevels reads her Latvian stories. You're listening to Life Rattle from Toronto, Ontario. And please remember that some Life Rattle stories contain language and situations that some listeners may find offensive, so listener discretion is advised.
My Flight by Ingrid Sevels, June 2001. My flight to Riga, Latvia takes 8 hours to Helsinki, Finland. From there, a 50-minute hop via Baltic Air will take me to the country of my ancestors, the country my parents escaped over 50 years ago. My daughter Sonia will meet me in Riga after her flight from London, England, Sonia's first visit to the Wild East, my fifth. When I board the Boeing 757 in Toronto, I say sveiks, hello, to the gray-haired, athletic-looking man who squeezes by me to sit in the middle seat in a row so tight we sit with our knees scrunched to our chests. How did you know I'm Latvian? He asks. Your ring, I say. He wears a traditional Latvian rope ring, the distinctive design of Latvian jewelry dating back to the pre-Christian era makes identification easy. Ivar introduces me to his travel partner, Glenn. Both Ivar's and Glenn's families, Latvian refugees like mine, immigrated to the United States in the 50s. Ivar and Glenn have already traveled from Michigan to Toronto to catch this flight. We buckle up, listen to the safety instructions, receive our earphones, and watch the news on the overhead screen. The news clip shows a riot in Ireland. Bums, says Ivar. Who, I ask. The rioters, they'll need the police someday. Yes, I say. How's your city? Is it safe, I ask? It's okay, except for the N factor, Ivar says. The N factor? You know, big lips. Oh, Negroes, I ask? Yes, he says. Have you ever been to Toronto, I ask Ivar and Glenn. I used to come to Toronto when I was younger. Too many undesirables there now, Ivar says. I tell Ivar and Glenn about my city, where the street signs in the Greek district on the Danforth display Greek letters, and in the Italian quarter in Italian letters, and in Chinatown in Chinese symbols, and how good and different the food tastes in the restaurants. Nice, they say. Dinner service starts. We all have a glass of wine. What do you guys do for a living, I ask. We just retired. Glenn and I met as rookie cops. I worked as a sergeant and headed the street crime division in Breitling, Michigan. I taught and trained new cops in the street crime division. I still train reserves to parachute jump, says Ivar. I left the police department and formed my own company, says Glenn. I own a forensic crime lab in the U.S. My specialty is document analysis. For instance, if someone says that a will was signed in 1970, I can tell if it was signed 2 months ago. We also do ballistic matching, DNA analysis, and retrieve erased data from computer hard drives. I do a lot of work for the FBI. In fact, the Riga Chief of Police will meet us to tour their training center. Oh, I say. What do you do for a living? Asks Glenn. I'm a dentist, I say. We discuss dental care, health care, politics, and Monica Lewinsky. But the conversation always returns to a favorite topic, guns. You know, if we put landmines on the border between Canada and U.S., we could keep undesirables and illegals out of our country, says Glenn. We were immigrants once. Guns plus people equal death. Take the guns out of the equation and maybe you won't have as many violent deaths, I say. It's the people, not the guns, that are at fault, says Glenn. Can't take the people out, I say. Yes, you can, says Glenn. You should have tougher gun control, I say. Are you kidding? When we go to Detroit, we take an extra round of ammo. You're kidding, I say. No. After dinner, the lights dim and we try to sleep upright. I stretch my legs in the aisle. Ivar and Glenn, both tall men, never complain, never move during the 8 hours. We disembark in Helsinki. The straps of my carry-on luggage, stuffed with gifts, dig into my shoulders. Ivar and Glenn scoop up my bags and sling them over their arms as if they were empty. As we enter the terminal, they don't talk to each other, they don't talk to me. Their eyes scan the room. Their eyes never stop moving. I feel safe, I think. We pass through Finnish customs and enter the transit area where we settle down to wait for 5 hours for our connecting flight to Riga. Glenn and Ivar buy me a coffee, watch my bags, and I share my granola bars. Do you always carry emergency rations? Asks Glenn. Yes, and water. Last time I was in Riga, the travel agent told us not to drink the water. I'm a bit paranoid about my health, I say. Paranoia is good, keeps you alive, especially in our business. When we get really paranoid, we sleep with ankle holsters, says Glenn. Uh-huh, I say. We stretch out in a spot where Glenn and Ivar can see the entire room at a glance, with the window behind our backs. We relax in Helsinki's pine-scented, wooden-floored airport with few people. Glenn reads a travel brochure about tick-borne encephalitis in Latvia. A tick, an insect the size of a mosquito, can bite a human or an animal and cause disease that can inflame the brain. I tell Glenn and Ivar that I researched the disease on the internet, had my doctor order the folder on the vaccine from the drug company, read the drug company folder from cover to cover, talked to a travel clinic doctor, phoned my cousin Andris in Latvia, found out about my relatives were all inoculated, and finally got inoculated with a vaccine that will protect me against tick-borne encephalitis. What are the symptoms, they ask? Mild symptoms, fever, headache, flu. Moderate symptoms, inflammation of the brain and spinal column, reversible. Severe symptoms, irreversible brain damage, death, I say. Their mouths open, their jaws drop, their eyes blink, then blink again, then lock on my eyes. What can we do? We didn't read the pamphlet beforehand. No one told us. An image of Ivar and Glenn reaching for their ankle holsters and shooting ticks flashes through my mind. But before my thought escapes into words, I say, wear long pants and long sleeves. Wear socks and shoes instead of sandals. Wear a hat. Shake your clothes, hair, and hat out when you come indoors. Use bug spray on your hands, face, and clothes. Go into woody, grassy areas only with protective clothing. Phew, we can do that, they say. We board Baltic Air, eat a reindeer meat sandwich, drink coffee, and descend into Riga. Welcome to Riga, announces the captain. I look out the window as the plane makes its approach. I see plot after plot of vegetable gardens in people's backyards. As we exit the terminal, I thank Glenn and Ivar for helping me with my bags. They thank me for advice on tick-borne encephalitis. I spot my cousin Andres and Edgar immediately. At 6'6", their heads tower above the other people awaiting guests. The uniformed Riga chief of police comes forward to meet Ivar and Glenn. Glenn introduces me quickly. The chief of police shakes my hand, says Sveiki, and how nice that you still speak Latvian. As he grins, his gold front teeth sparkle at me. I can't take my eyes off his gold teeth. Andres and Edgar scowl at the uniform, pick up my bags, stand like sentries on either side of me, and escort me to their car. Glenn and Ivar climb into a brand new 4x4 police SUV with revolving yellow light on top. I wave goodbye and say, Uzredzēšanos, see you again sometime. Fraud and Corruption by Ingrid Sevels. My cousin Andres and I, on a Saturday morning, walk through the small town of Smiltene, Latvia, my mother's hometown of 85 years ago. As we cross the market square, a 4x4 with an official-looking crest on the door zooms by. We and other pedestrians leap out of the Land Rover's path. Banditi, yells Andres and shakes his fist at the car. Who are they? I ask. Apsargi, protectors, says Andres. You mean the police? I ask. No, these guys go to the local businesses and demand payment from proprietors to protect their premises. If you as a proprietor do not pay, they throw a brick through the window, rob you, physically harm you, or worse. You mean it's a racket? Yes. Why don't you go to the police, I ask? Pfft, says Andres. Andres's wife owns a small flower shop in Smiltene. Does Sandra's store have a protection, I ask? No, they don't bother us because our flower store is so small. Sandra's 85-year-old mother saved and saved and finally put hard-saved money in a newly opened bank in town. The bank promised a 15% return on the deposits. When all the old people in town deposited their money, the bankers closed the doors to the bank, declared bankruptcy, and disappeared without a trace. Nobody, absolutely nobody, bothers to find them. The police don't do a thing. Thugs, that's who runs our country. Thugs, says Andres. I don't understand, I say. Sandra woke one morning to find her car radio stolen. Did you leave your car unlocked, I ask. No, they have keys, he says. Why don't you go to the police, I ask. Pfft, he waves his arm. They'll just ask me why I didn't take the radio out every night. The police know who the thieves are. Then why don't the police do something? Andres shrugs. Sandra, about to buy a newer car, cannot order one but has to wait for whatever the dealer has to offer. Where do they get their cars from, I ask. Don't know. They come with papers, police registration, but everyone knows the cars are stolen. We will have to insure the car and pay well for the insurance, he says. What do you mean? If your car is not insured well, banditi steal your car and then ask for you to buy it back. They warn you not to go to the police, and if you do, you will never see your car again, says Andres. So, in effect, you buy your car twice, I say. Yes, If you insure well, then they leave your car alone. In other words, the thieves and the insurers are one and the same, says Andres. And the police, I ask? Andres shrugs. We walk home. Andres' daughter Aya and my daughter Sonia sit on the front porch. Sonia asks about Aya's summer job. We saw an ad in the Riga newspaper advertising jobs in Spain. Four of us got in a car and drove south through Lithuania, Poland, Germany, France, and then into Spain, says Aya. Where did you sleep? Asks Sonia. In the car. Two people drove and two slept at all times. We stopped to go to the bathroom at the roadside or at gas stations. We cooked our food over a Coleman stove or on an open fire by the roadside, mostly macaroni and sausages. When we got to Spain, we couldn't find the address given in the paper, but we finally found the farm, says Aya. We each had to pay the proprietor $100 so that we could get the job. You had to buy your work? Asks Sonia. Yes, says Aya. What was the job? Picking garlic, trimming the leaves, and packing garlic in crates for shipping to market. Aya shows us the pictures of their outdoor living quarters. The picture shows smiling young people in a field under a canopy made of sheets held up by poles. Beds made from straw. Toilet in the fields, washing down at the river's edge. We spent the day from sunrise to sunset in the fields. We had to work off the $100. We had to earn our food. At the end of the day, the owner gave us sausages and bread. That was considered payment. After 3 weeks, we still hadn't received any money. They wanted our passports, says Aya. How did you get home? Asks Sonia. I had a cell phone, so I phoned my mom. Mom sent us gas money. The guys slept with knives by their sides as they were afraid that our car would be stolen. If they take your passports, there's no escape. Women get sold into prostitution, says Aya. How did you escape? Asked Sonia. We crept away in the middle of the night. We complained to the Latvian embassy in Spain. They just shrugged. They said the person responsible could not be found. The agency has moved and closed. What about the police? I ask. Aya shrugs. I struggle to understand their system. After Sonia and I spent hours at the newly opened Museum of Occupation in Riga, I learn more about the Reign of Terror, where intimidation and silencing tactics protected criminals. During Soviet occupation, the Terminator was an armed person who put an end to counter-revolutionary activities. From 1924 to 1953, in the Stalinist era, the Soviets used the Internal Security Agency, called the Cheka, to eliminate subversive activities. The Russians renamed this organization and called it the KGB. I remember my parents discussing the dreaded Cheka and KGB in hushed whispers. After the liberation of Latvia in 1991, democracy struggles to prevail and these agencies disappeared, but the people that ran them remain. The legacy lives on in 2001. The criminal element still flourishes. Midsummer Night Crisis by Ingrid Sevels. The headline in the evening news in Smiltene, Latvia reads, Esiet prātīgi, be sensible. The picture beneath the caption shows a naked reveler striding into the lake, a wreath of oak leaves wrapped around his head. Today, Latvians will celebrate the longest day of the year, the summer solstice. By lakes, near forests, in fields, Latvians drink, eat, dance, sing, worship the sun and nature, and leap over bonfires. During the Russian occupation, the communist regime forbade religious holidays. Quietly, Behind closed doors and drawn curtains, Latvians celebrated Christmas and Easter. The Russians allowed the summer solstice celebration Yanyi, or St. John's Day. On Yanyi, people stay up all night. Daylight fades in a rosy glow at midnight, and even then it doesn't get completely dark. On this night, couples go into the wood to search for the mythical fern blossom in the moonlight. My cousin Andres says, that's how babies are made. I continue to read the news as I sit on the front porch behind a box of pansies next to the greenhouse my cousin Andres built. Andres rises at 5 a.m. every morning to labor 10 hours for a road construction company. In his spare time, he fixes his house. Andres has extended his kitchen, added an extra bathroom, put a small fish pond in his front lawn, installed hot water pipes in his greenhouse so that his wife Sandra can grow food all year round. Andres, a frustrated scientist, shows me pictures of the hot air balloon he constructed that made headlines in the Latvian national newspaper. I read that last year at Yanyi, 23 people lost their lives, 100 injured because of drunk driving. Save your friends, don't let them drive drunk. This year, banners proclaim this message on roads leading into and out of Riga. I read on. 38 people in the Smiltene region contracted trichinoma parasite when they ate pork. The picture shows a roasted boar's head, yellow marigolds in place of the eyes, dillweed in the ears, purple chive blossoms in the mouth, and a cucumber curl crown on its head. The article warns Yanyi revelers not to eat pork from unknown vendors, as infected wild boar meat mixed with ordinary pork caused the trichinoma outbreak last year. Trichinoma, trichinosis, I think. I remember a journal article about parasite trichinosis. A person in Canada contracted the trichinosis parasite either because they ate infected, improperly cooked pork or because they ate lettuce fertilized with infected pig feces. The parasite entered the bloodstream, traveled to the floor of the mouth where the body defense mechanism encapsulated the parasite to make it appear like a cyst. I remember seeing how the worm looked, curled on a slide under the microscope after the surgeon cut it out and sent it to a pathology lab. I shudder. What do you use for fertilizer in your greenhouse? I ask Andres's wife, Sandra. She shows me a bottle of chemical fertilizer made in Germany that she adds to the water. I let out a deep breath. I put the paper down. We prepare for the evening activities. Aya, my cousin's daughter, takes us to fields where we pick wild daisies, blue cornflowers, yellow buttercups, green rushes, oak branches, oak grass, jasmine branches, wild roses, and birch leaves. We bring our cuttings home and lay our Yanyi grasses on the front lawn. We weave flower head wreaths. The traditional male oak wreath symbolizes strength and virility. The traditional woman's wreath celebrates beauty and symbolizes fertility. Aya and Sandra show Sonia and me how to weave the head wreaths for women. Everyone must wear a head wreath this evening, says Sandra. Sandra's fingers move quickly. She takes two daisies, adds cornflowers, repeats the sequence, and weaves a strand. She takes the chain of flowers and puts it around my head to measure my head size. She ties off the chain with a blade of supple grass, string is not allowed, and plops the wreath on my head. Sonia braids three wreaths to encircle her head. She adds a tail and hangs down to the shoulder and attaches a bunch of flowers with a feather grass that sticks out at the side. It looks like it came from America, says Aya. Everyone laughs at Sonia's crazy design. Sonia and Aya make cornflower braids and attach them to the car antenna. They wrap the windshield wipers in daisies, buttercups, and ferns. Andres shows Sonia how to decorate the house and place 10-foot-long birch branches in pickle jars and place them in each room on each side of the entrance to the house. Sonia sits among the grasses and scratches, itches, and sneezes. She lifts her t-shirt up. Tiny red, angry hives, thousands of them, blanket her torso, front and back. Sandra immediately calls her friend at the emergency medical center in Smiltener, where they still apply live leeches to arthritic knees. 10 minutes later, a square truck with a red cross on the side rattles up the gravel road to the house. A stout, red-haired woman in green uniform carrying a black bag gets out. She takes Sonia's blood pressure, notes her pulse, examines her torso, and says, "Yes, probably a reaction to the field flowers." She suggests an injection of colchis. I rack my brain for the translation. "Is it called another name that I might recognize?" I ask. "No," Dr. Villa says. I look at Sonia. Sonia looks at me. We both shake our heads. Last year, a travel agent told tourists to be wary of any medical emergencies requiring injections, as recycled, unsterilized needles sold to unsuspecting medics could possibly carry HIV and hepatitis. "Do you have antihistamine tablets?" I ask. "I'll have to get some," says Dr. Villa. The truck rattles down the road and back again. Dr. Villa gives Sonia 2 Terragel tablets. These seem similar to Claritin. I offer to pay. Dr. Villa refuses. We thank her and she accepts the gift of Canadian Pacific salmon. "Have you been busy this weekend?" asks Sandra. "No car accidents yet. Only an outbreak of salmonella poisoning," she says. "From what?" I ask. "From unrefrigerated cakes made with raw eggs," she says. I look at her for a moment and mentally review the ingredients for the evening meal Sonia and I will cook, a Canadian meal that will consist of Greek salad, Chinese wok vegetables, and Italian bruschetta. Dinner Preparations by Ingrid Sevels. Andres, my cousin, enters the kitchen and hands my daughter, Sonia, and me huge mugs of home-brewed, newly fermented Yanyu beer. "Thanks," I say. "At least it isn't the fermented birch sap I got yesterday," I think. "Good for the health," he says. "Prosit." I take a sip. "Good," I say. "Good for brain damage," I think. I pour the beer bit by bit into the sink when I have a chance, whenever Andres looks the other way. I leave some in the mug so I can say, "No thanks, I still have some," when he offers to refill my glass. Andres opens the fridge and pulls out a slab of fatty bacon. Fatty bacon makes Sonia and me gag. Andres cuts off a thick slice, puts it on a piece of thick black rye bread, and eats it as a snack before dinner. Andres makes open-faced sandwiches for Sonia and me. "Ne paldies, no thank you," we say. "No mirs bada, you will die of famine," he says. Latvians know what a food shortage means. Before liberation from communism in 1991, during 50 years of Soviet occupation and deprivation, the markets and stores stood empty. People survived because they built their own greenhouses, grew their own vegetables, raised their own rabbits, chickens, and ducks. "What do you grow in your backyard?" "In Canada," Andres asks. "Grass," I say. "No mirs bada, you will die of famine." The Latvian prisoners who returned from Siberia survived because they ate grass soup, says Andris. From 1940 to 1956, Latvia lost 560,000 men, women, and children, 28% of its population. The Soviets deported entire families, men, women, and children, to Siberia, where the slave labor, starvation, cold, degradation, and disease brought death and meant many would never see their homeland again. The Russians now brag about their prosperous Siberian industrial ugly cities in the tundra, built on the blood and bones of dead slave laborers. Some prisoners returned. My parents evaded deportation. They escaped across the Baltic Sea to Sweden in an 18-foot fishing boat. Andris survived the Siberian gulag. He returned home. He comes to the stove and peers in the pan. No meat, he says. He cuts up bacon to add to the pan. No, this is a Canadian meal. We don't eat fat, Sonia and I say. No mirspada, he says. Use the back burner. I like the front one. I do have a stove in Canada. Use the back one, Andris says. Why? Because I hooked up the back burner so that it bypasses the gas meter. Andris pours himself another beer, pours a beer for me, and pours one for Sonia. Sandra, Andris's wife, finally returns home, tired and hungry. Ah, smells delicious in here, she says. Sandra owns a flower shop in Smiltene. Andris built the flower shop by chopping trees in the forest. With three funerals, school graduation, and the holiday Janu celebration, Sandra rises at 4 every morning to fill her orders. Andris offers the bacon again. Sandra puts it in the fridge. Andris takes it out. Dinner's ready, says Sonia. Sonia, Aya, Sandra, and Andris and I sit and eat our Canadian meal of Greek salad, Chinese wok vegetables on rice and Italian bruschetta, avocados filled with shrimps marinated in lime juice. Andris takes a bite of avocado. Tastes like soap, he says. He rises from the table, staggers, and disappears to the bedroom. Too many new tastes, says Sandra. As we eat, I crunch and swallow something hard. Andris must have added some bacon grizzle to the pan. I run my tongue along my bottom teeth. Everything feels normal. I run my tongue along my top teeth and stop at my upper left molar, second from the back. The tip of my tongue finds a hole. Damn. The third day into a 2-week trip and I ate my filling. I fear that Sandra will drag me off to a dentist. Some dentists in the Baltics still cold sterilize their instruments because they're not up to date with latest techniques, because they lack industry standards and guidelines, or simply because they cannot afford autoclaves. Cold sterilization does not kill HIV and hepatitis B. I take another bite of food and eat slowly, carefully, quietly. I keep the food on one side of my mouth. I feel another crunch between my teeth. Now I put my entire tongue in the space between my first and second molar. After dinner, I sneak around the house and look for a candle. A candle sits on the table, but this candle contains insecticide, and I need a plain candle. I find gum, chew until the flavor and sugar are gone, stick the gum on my tooth, and the sharp edge of my tooth no longer cuts my tongue. I walk into Smiltene and go to the apothecary and ask if they have candles. Go next door to the flower shop, the druggist says. That's Sandra's store. If I go in there, they'll ask me why I need the candle. I go across the street to a small shop. I see a plain white candle. I pay the shopkeeper 20 centimes and walk home. Thank God I'm staying at Andres's house and not at my cousin Edgar's house, where there's no plumbing or running water inside the house, and where I would have to go to the well and haul up the water and then heat it on the wood stove. I turn on the hot water in Andres's bathroom. I soften the tip of the candle, brush my tooth well to dislodge any food stuck in the cavern, roll a small piece of wax between my fingers into a ball, and place the ball of wax in the hole of my broken tooth. I bite down. My temporary wax filling stays in place. Drive to the Anya Concert by Ingrid Sevels. My cousin Andres and my cousin Edgar hand me the car keys. Tu brauts, you drive, they say. I slide in behind the steering wheel, reach for the seat belt. No seat belt. I push in the clutch and practice the gears. First, second, third, fourth, reverse. Reverse doesn't work, I say. Put it in neutral, straighten your wheels, take your foot off the brake, they say. Andres and Edgar, 6'6", 200-pound Nordic giants, push the car backwards so that I can drive forward. Andres and Edgar get in the back seat. Ausma, Edgar's wife, sits in the front seat next to me. I rev the engine of the 1960 Moscovich. We open the window so the carbon monoxide that rises through the rusted floorboards can escape. I can see daylight beneath my foot that rests on the brake. Sonia takes a picture of my vintage car. I take a picture of Sonia's Ford Diesel. Flowers decorate the antenna and windshield wipers. Aya, Andres's daughter, sticks her head out of the sunroof. Sonia sticks her head out the window, and Liga and her boyfriend hang their wreathed heads out the back window. The Moscovich leads. Aya and the driver's seat of the Ford follow. Andres and Edgar open refreshments in the back seat. Home-brewed beer, vodka, and fermented birch sap. They pass a bottle around and hand it to me. I wet my lips with the liquid and pass the bottle back. I didn't bring my driver's license. What if the police stop us, I say. Just shrug and speak English. Hand the cop this bottle of vodka, and if that doesn't work, there's some money in the glove compartment. Chikubriku okidoki, I say. We haven't talked to each other since the last time you visited, 4 years ago, says Andres. They laugh and talk between swigs and give me directions. I watch the road. I drive around potholes the size of small swimming pools. I slow down so the rear of the car doesn't scrape gravel. There's no money to fix the roads. All the money went to fixing the runways at the airport so that you tourists can have a soft landing. And government officials drive brand new Mercedes in Riga, says Andres. 50-some years of communist rule and deprivation have made them tough. 50-some years of capitalist excess have made me soft, I think. Your airport is world-class. I'm not exactly a tourist, I say. Look at the fields, says Ausma. The flowers are pretty. Yes, flowers, says Andres. Nobody plows and seeds and cultivates grain anymore. It doesn't pay. Farming is out. Business is in. Ausma starts a Latvian drinking song. Skaista ir jaunība, beautiful is youth, never will it return. Edgar and Andres join in. I try to follow, try to remember the turns in the road so that I can backtrack. We reach the concert park, park the cars in the middle of a mud field in the middle of Latvia, in the middle of nowhere. I pay 2 lats. $5 admission per person and 3 for the car. We could eat for a week on that money, says Ausma. We walk through the fields among small bonfires. Fire worship, a leftover pagan ritual to pay homage to the gods of life and fertility. We walk toward a field where hundreds of people sit in the grass in front of a wooden bandstand. Andres spots a small pond and staggers down to the water's edge, sits down, undresses, and plunges into the water. Refreshed, he crawls out, dresses, and opens the vodka bottle. "What are we going to give to the cops?" I ask. He mutters, takes a swig, and passes the bottle. "Trinken," Andres says. Trinken, English, German, Latvian, all in one word. We wait for the band Los Amigos, the most popular band in the country. The black American lead singer teaches Latvians the rhythm and sounds of rap. Latvians teach him Latvian. Together they rap. Los Amigos are the new phenomenon. Cut off from the West for 50 years behind the darkness of the Iron Curtain, Latvians now crave new music, new cultures, new ideas, and new food. After Los Amigos, Aya wants to go back to Smiltenes Mežaparks, Forest Park, to dance, drink, and roast sausages on the bonfires and eat homemade Jani cheese with friends. Can we follow you back? Do you know the way? Asks Aya. I think so, I say. In the mud field, the Moskovich's back wheels spin. Andres and Edgar lift the back wheels and push. Darkness cloaks the road. I see no lights, no signs. I hear no directions from the back seat. The beer bottles lay empty. The vodka bottle lays empty. The birch sap bottle lays empty. Edgar teaches me Russian swear words. Chort vazmi. Best fibro. Kurva yomat. Put more gravel in your voice, growls Edgar. I try again. Latvians don't have good swear words. That's why there's so many Russians in our country. We can't tell them to get lost. We can't tell them to get the hell out of our country, says Andres. Andres taps me on the shoulder. Stop, he says. I stop the car. He opens a door and falls into the ditch, gets up and pees on the bushes. He weaves and lurches and bobs among the field flowers and we wait. Edgar sticks his head out the window and yells, "Get back here, how long does it take you to piss?" Andres manages to reach the car upright and hands me a bouquet of field daisies. A wet patch stains his pants. Shame he shows not. By the time I reach Smiltenes, 5 bouquets of field flowers lie in my lap. We park the car at home and walk to the forest park. At the forest park, I take a shot of rot-gut potato vodka. The liquid burns down my throat. "Will you teach me to drive?" Ausma asks. "Yes, tomorrow," I say. "How was your drive, Sonia?" Sonia says, "Tomorrow, Mum. I'll tell you tomorrow." Flight Home by Ingrid Sevels. July 2001. Edgar and Ausma, Andres, Aya, Sandra, Sonia, and I sit and drink coffee near the entrance to the departure gate in the Riga airport. We talk and laugh. Edgar promises me he won't swear in Russian when he teaches his wife Ausma to drive. Andres rants about food in Canada, a country he has not visited. "You don't know how to eat and drink. Your apples don't have worms because you use too much pesticide. Your pigs grow to maturity in 6 months because you use too many growth hormones. No wonder you won't eat bacon. Our pigs grow for 2 years," he says. Time for me to go. I hug and kiss everyone and tell Sonia to be careful in Riga as she will catch her flight to London the next day. Sonia gives me her usual eye roll. Sandra asks me to quietly to inquire about a job prospect in Canada for Aya. I say I will. I turn the corner, wave, blow kisses, and disappear behind the screen, carrying my once again heavy bags stuffed with gifts from my relatives. Woolen mittens for my entire family knit on 6 needles with designs and motifs more beautiful than the hand-knit art displays I saw in the museum. Linen tablecloths spun from flax grown in local fields. Enriga's Black Balsam Alcoholic, good for the health, elixir, made from 99 grasses. Andres gave me the elixir in return for my gift of Canadian Crown Royal Rye Whiskey in a crystal-cut glass bottle encased in a blue velvet bag that Andres left untouched on one of his drinking binges because he thought it was a bottle of perfume. The luggage scanner scans my luggage. I enter the waiting area and spot Glenn and Ivar, the retired U.S. police officers that I sat with on the flight to Latvia. They rise, smile, shake my hand, move over to let me sit between them. They want to hear about my trip, and I want to hear about theirs. We board and continue our conversation in Helsinki, where we wait again for 5 hours to catch our flight to Toronto. Ivar, his eyes at half-mast, doesn't talk much. "What's wrong with you? Did you get bitten by a tick?" I ask. "He's drying out," says Glenn. I tell them about the feeling I lost. They laugh. "That's like you guys getting a speeding ticket," I say. No laughter. "What did you do at the Riga Police Department?" I ask. "We toured the ballistics and firearms department," says Glenn. "Of course," I say. "The United States donated a machine to the Latvian police department that retrieves images like footprints and erasing handwriting, only they don't know how to use it. We will have to train them." I ask how the Janič celebrations went. Glenn and Ivar tell me Ivar's cousin drank so much that he hallucinated and passed out. Glenn and Ivar had to resuscitate him. They also tell me that the Latvian police stopped them to check Glenn and Ivar for drunk driving. Ivar and the cop's mother came from the same town, so we struck up a friendship, had a chat, you know. We're glad we didn't have to pull our badges. They ask me what Sonia's thoughts about Latvia were on her first visit. I tell them she couldn't understand why the young people seemed so directionless and indecisive. We discuss communist ideology and the toll communism has taken. We switch to capitalism. The United States was built by honest people and is now being ruined by a corrupt government run by crooks, says Glenn. Who are the crooks? The Chinese conspiracy got Clinton elected. You look at their names. Names like Greenspan, says Len. Gidi, Jews, spits Ivar. And what did you hear about the police corruption in Riga? Glenn and Ivar shrug. We board. Glenn and Ivar sit in bulkhead seats and stretch their legs. I sit further back in the plane and enjoy the luxury of 3 seats to myself. I tell them not to miss the feature film on the board. Billy Elliot, one of my favorites. What's it about, they ask. It's about a young boy who wants to be a ballet dancer. Glenn and Ivar both give me vacant, disbelieving stares. 8 hours later, the buckle your seatbelt sign flashes and we descend into Pearson International Airport. As the wheels touch the runway, I, for the first time, clap with the rest of the passengers. I'm home, I'm home, I'm home.
That was Ingrid Sevels reading her Latvian stories. And that concludes Life Rattle number 1358. Arnie Ackman recorded Ingrid Sevels reading her stories. My name is Virginia Ashbury. Life Rattle is produced from Toronto, Ontario, and was created by Guy Allen and Arnie Ackman.